It just wouldn't be summer without a controversy over dunes at the Jersey Shore. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Margate residents are up in arms, and officials are threatening to sue over flooding that shut off access to much of the beach. The flooding is tied to newly built sand dunes, as WHYY's Tom McDonald reports.
The mini lake between the new protective dunes being built is blocking access to about 40% of Margate's beach, says Mayor Mike Becker.
We in Margate have had the waters tested down there. We want to see what the bacterial level is. We're very concerned about the safety of our citizens. We have scheduled a special meeting for Wednesday morning at 11 o'clock in which we will discuss and possibly take action on hiring an outside counsel seeking an injunction to stop the project.
Margate resident Patty DeRose says she didn't understand why Governor Chris Christie and the Army Corps pushed for the dunes. It leaves stormwater from the streets draining towards the area behind the dunes.
If they really cared, Christie would have been here instead of at that ball game last night eating his nachos. He would have been here. Okay, and he would have seen that we flood from the bay. There are some places on the bay that have no bulkheads.
Steve Rochette of the Army Corps of Engineers says the ponds were built to catch stormwater as part of the dune project, and it keeps stormwater from going directly into the ocean.
The purpose for those basin areas between the dune and the bulkheads is to provide space, essentially, for the city's stormwater from the streets. It goes through holes on the boardwalk, and so that area was sort of built out and excavated to provide to accommodate that stormwater, whereas before it went through the holes and was kind of trenched down towards the ocean.
Residents and city officials say they were told the water would subside in 24 hours. It's lasted days. Paula Dresden lives a few homes from the beach and says now is the time for solutions to their problem.
Nobody's very happy. And I think that the engineers should have figured this out before they started, not after.
Construction on more dunes continues as part of a much bigger project up and down the shore. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
A swimming fatality over the weekend along the Jersey Shore is the latest evidence of the potential dangers of an otherwise fun-filled vacation season. Let's look at the potential of rip currents with Justin Osiello, NewsWorks Down the Shore blogger. Justin, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
I'm not sure if the case in question was definitely related to rip current, also popularly called undertow or rip tides. How about a working definition of rip current?
A rip current is a channel of churning, choppy water heading seaward. Now, how do you identify it? Well, it takes a bit of experience, but if you spend some time in the Jersey Shore, I recommend that you sit on the beach and you look out towards the water. You can identify it by seeing, typically an area having a noticeable difference in water color, sometimes a line of foam, seaweed, or debris that's moving seaward, or a break in the incoming wave pattern.
Is there a typical width or length of a rip current?
You know what, Dave? It all depends on the local conditions at any given beach. Some could extend for, 50 to 75 yards. Others can go for hundreds of yards. It really all depends. And one thing that's very important as well is that rip current speeds vary. They have an average pull typically of about 1 to 2 feet per second, but some can move as fast as 8 feet per second. Now that's faster than an Olympic swimmer like Michael Phelps.
What are some tips in defying the instinct to fight it and come to shore?
Well, Dave, the first tip that I always recommend, and I've been reporting on rip current safety for years now, and it's something that we do quite often on the Down the Shore blog. You know, there have been multiple tragedies this summer. There was a drowning in Sandy Hook. There were two in Belmar, one in Point Pleasant Beach, which was actually the other night, unfortunately, and two in Atlantic City earlier this summer. The first thing that you should always do is you should always swim in front of a lifeguard. When lifeguards are not on duty, you should never enter the water. That is your first line of defense. Swim near a lifeguard. You should also always check in with the lifeguards. You should ask them about the current conditions, where you should swim, what you should avoid. Another thing prior to the beach is that you should check the surf forecast from the National Weather Service. You can find it very easily by Googling surf zone forecast New Jersey or Delaware, and you'll be able to find that information that's posted on a daily basis. Now, if you're caught in a rip current, The number one thing that experts say is to stay calm. People often drown quickly because they lose their energy and they get very anxious. And a rip current does not pull you under. That is a huge misnomer. It does not pull you under. But what happens is that you lose your breath and you lose your energy and you just sink. Okay? So number one, stay calm. Number two, do not fight it. Okay? As you're being pulled out, try to escape by going parallel to the shore. Now, rip currents typically are not extremely wide. So if you try, you should be able to escape by swimming parallel. Once you feel like you're out, then swim towards the shoreline. If you feel like you can't escape, Dave, you need to signal out. You need to signal towards the beach, wave your hand. And one thing for the rescuers, you should always call 911. There have been countless tragedies of people attempting to make a rescue, and they're the ones who lose their lives. So if you see someone in trouble, call 911 immediately, give the dispatcher the location of where you are, and they will dispatch people out to the location.
Justin, despite your obvious extensive experience and vigilance, have you ever been caught up in a rip current?
Dave, yes. I'm 37 years old. I've been surfing since I was about 5 years old. So more than 30 years of surfing. I've been caught in numerous rip currents, but I've always been able to free myself because I know how to deal with them. And just to add, I've pulled countless people out of rip currents as well. Surfers are usually the first line of defense. We're usually the ones who are out there in the water, and we're able to see people that are getting pulled out seaward. So I've been caught in them. I've rescued people. And Dave, let me tell you, when I rescued people with my surfboard, the relief in their face, it's like something that you'll never forget. They're just so grateful that someone was there to rescue them. And I've been told by people that I've pulled out, they said, thankfully you were there, because I don't think there was any way that I was going to be able to get out of this water.
Thanks, Justin.
Thank you, Dave.
NewsWorks Down the Shore blogger Justin Ausiello on NewsWorks Tonight. Many SEPTA riders have complained that the cards, kiosks, and website for its new electronic fare card system are difficult to use. As Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly reports, a local design firm and some civic-minded coders have offered SEPTA some free advice on how to make these systems user-friendly.
The Transit Authority's new electronic fare card, SEPTA Key, is supposed to make life easier for riders. But a lot of people have wound up with a second fare card when all they wanted to do was add money onto their first one.
So I hit contactless card. $20. Boom! Now I have a second card.
I thought that I had punched all the right things, but out came a second SEPTA key card.
Thinking I was following the correct prompt, I accidentally ordered a third key.
This is my fifth time doing it and the first time that it worked.
That was Steve McCaffrey, Magda Konechna, Pat Woods, and Olivia Duffy. Just a fraction of the dozens and dozens of SEPTA customers who shared their key frustrations with WHYY. The problem is that SEPTA's fare card kiosks are fairly difficult to use. They have bad UX, or user experience, the design discipline that tries to make products intuitive and easy to use. You know how an iPad is so easily operated a baby can do it? That's because Apple has great UX. SEPTA's UX, not so much. The kiosk user interface is so bad that a group of UX designers from Think Company got together with programs from Code of Philly and transit advocates from Fifth Square to come up with a better one. And they did, in about 3 hours. Mind you, SEPTA has been working on the key for about 6 years. Brian McIntyre is the chief design officer at Think Company.
This is just probably the worst example or a glaring example of how it's not clear how to use the system.
McIntyre is talking about the first screen you see when you go to use the SEPTA key kiosk. It shows two prompts, one that says no card and the other that says contactless card. They look like buttons. And a lot of users who just want to add money to their card touch that second prompt, the contactless card one. But they're supposed to tap their key card against a separate reader, which is what the first screen says in teeny tiny font that no one seems to notice. And if you touch the screen first before tapping your card, you'll end up with a new card. It doesn't help that SEPTA uses unclear technical jargon instead of easily understood terms.
The internal language can be quite confusing. There's the SEPTA key, There's a contactless card. There's the travel wallet. As a first-time user, you're not sure exactly what they're going for.
That's Dave Brindley, a campus minister with the group Crew. After Brindley ran into difficulty adding money to his own key card, he set out to do something about it. Since he didn't have technical know-how, Brindley recruited some volunteers to help figure out the transit authority's UX problems. In the end, they handed SEPTA a 27-page document detailing how a handful of small tweaks could improve the kiosk user interface. As for the website, well, Brindley says there's no fixing that.
The website is just a hot mess, and that just needs to be nuked and rebuilt from scratch.
SEPTA knows the keys UX is bad. Deputy General Manager Rich Burnfield says the agency is working with its contractor to fix it.
So we've heard from our customers about the website. We've heard from our customers about the fare kiosks. So we are working with Conduit to make changes to the screens, to the fare kiosks.
Starting this week, SEPTA will begin publicly beta testing a new user interface. If the pilot program works and customers stop accidentally getting extra cards, the fix will be deployed system-wide. SEPTA is also amending its contract with Conduit to get a new website for SEPTA Key, one that's easier to use and works seamlessly on all devices. That is the 16th change order the agency has made to the SEPTA Key contract, which may help explain why the project is now scheduled to wrap up sometime next year, more than 4 years after it was originally supposed to be finished. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
Conrail began work today to clean up a stretch of railroad tracks in Philadelphia that's been home to a vast encampment of heroin users. Outreach workers were out in force this morning, helping those struggling with addiction who are being displaced by the cleanup. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Joel Wolfram reports.
Israel Reyes is standing outside an outreach trailer at A and Tusculum Streets, just across the street from the Conrail tracks where he woke up.
Yes, I've been living down the railroad tracks almost for 2 years and a half. Yep, that's my residence.
Reyes says drug addiction brought him down there after he separated from his wife. He's here with a caseworker from Pathways to Housing, who's been working for the past 2 months to find him a spot in supportive housing. Reyes took their help when he heard that Conrail would be shutting down access to the tracks. Pathways to Housing doesn't have an apartment for him yet, but he'll finally have a roof over his head again. He's going to stay at a shelter at Prevention Point, Philadelphia.
There's a lot of people living down on the tracks that needs help.
Reyes is one of up to 75 homeless drug users that were still living at the tracks as of last week. Countless others go down there just to shoot up heroin. But they can't stay much longer. Once cleanup crews get to places where the drug users camp, police officers will remove anyone who remains. Outreach workers wearing orange shirts were roaming the area, trying to enroll them in treatment and housing. Conrail and City Managing Director Michael DeBerardinas are trying to assure the community that they'll be sticking around to help long after the cleanup.
So we want to lift up this problem. We want to treat the folks who are addicted. We want to treat folks who have this heroin addiction.
City officials say 15 people signed up for treatment on this first day of the cleanup. Many residents worry that the cleanup will push drug users to other parts of the neighborhood, but Israel Reyes says that the help from Prevention Point and Pathways to Housing makes him hopeful.
Everything is going to get better. Hopefully, you know.
For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
Court officials in Philadelphia recently approved the first pay raise for court-appointed defense attorneys since the mid-1990s. Then, city officials looked at the proposed pay increases and said they're not sure where the money will come from. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the confusion is having real consequences for some of the most vulnerable people in the criminal justice system.
Most people charged with crimes in Philadelphia are too poor to afford their own attorney. Often they're represented by a public defender. But if multiple people are arrested for the same crime, the public defender can only represent one of them. The rest have to get court-appointed attorneys. These private lawyers take on thousands and thousands of cases a year.
I joke that it's God's work, but it's not It's really not that much of a joke.
That's attorney Marnie Snyder, who, until recently, did court-appointed work. The low pay was just the start of the problem.
After a while, I was getting late checks. I was getting my fees cut by significant amounts.
She says court-appointed clients represented 70% of her work, but just 20% of her income. For a typical case that could take weeks, she was getting paid a flat fee of $400, which didn't cover everything she did.
There is no place to record how many times you visited someone at the prison, and so I noticed that lawyers don't visit their court-appointed clients at the prison.
Snyder couldn't take it anymore, so she removed her name from what criminal defense attorneys call the list. And that's bad for poor people who are charged with crimes. The more people leave the court-appointed list, the more stress is on the whole system. Ron Greenblatt used to head Philly's Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
You don't have experienced attorneys, so people get longer sentences. They won't get adequate representation, which could lead to wrongful convictions.
Court officials know this is a problem, so at the end of last month, they issued a court order increasing rates. It's a big deal, since this hasn't happened since the 1990s. But it would add $5 million to a $9 million budget for court-appointed attorneys, and right now, the city doesn't know where that money's going to come from. A spokeswoman for the mayor's office called the pay bump, quote, premature, but said officials are doing everything they can to comply with the court order. But if the city doesn't come up with a plan, there could be consequences. Here's Greenblatt.
We anticipate that if this funding isn't brought to bear and people aren't paid what they're owed, that the lawyers will want to sue.
In other words, if the city doesn't pay what it owes, Greenblatt says he'll be representing attorneys on the list, suing the city for shortchanging them. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
Now just 3 weeks out from a total solar eclipse traversing the United States, let's follow the sun with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, those lucky enough to be in the direct path will experience totality for some 2.5 minutes. NASA has the means to deploy a solar stretcher.
Yes, NASA plans to study the corona during the solar eclipse in an effort to try to better understand why the corona is so hot, but even more so, why the corona at such incredible temperature of millions of degrees is so uniform in its structure. But in order to do this, they need a much longer period of time to observe totalities, so 2 minutes 30 or 40 seconds really doesn't do it for them. Their intent is to use two retired military bombers with cameras on board to stretch out the time. So they'll do this by flying along at about 470 miles an hour. So they'll get about 8 minutes of totality out of it altogether.
Are these drone flights, or will there be pilots lucky enough to experience it?
They actually are piloted aircraft, and it's a very kind of interesting maneuver that they're going to be doing. They're going to come at the eclipse shadow, the moon shadow, from two sides, and they're going to use this as a way to gather as much information as they can from different directions. That'll maximize their resolution and a few other things. But they're not going to be able to keep up with the shadow because the shadow will be moving at 1,400 miles an hour.
Now, too bad they can't bring that supersonic Concorde out of retirement. It was more than four decades ago that it chased a total solar eclipse. It was able to keep up for over an hour.
Yes, it did very, very well. This was back in 1973. A group of astronomers decided to follow that eclipse using the Concorde. And with supersonic transport, they could manage to keep up for 74 minutes.
Unless you're traveling south, Philadelphia region residents will also miss out. When was the last time a total solar eclipse traversed the city of brotherly love?
The last time a total solar eclipse passed over Philadelphia, you ready for this? 539 years ago, just last Friday, 1478. So there's no real historical record of that eclipse taking place here in the Americas, although that's the last time a total solar eclipse passed right over Philadelphia as we now know it.
Can we work the numbers and determine when the next one might come?
We certainly can. The next total solar eclipse for Philadelphia is in 2079. That says that solar eclipses are rare, right? No, they aren't actually rare. You can have no less than two, no more than five in a year, although five is really, really, really rare. But what makes solar eclipses rare is where they occur.
Because the bandwidth of totality is so narrow?
It's more because of the geometry of how this whole thing works. It's like the planet Earth is just the canvas for this incredible dance of celestial mechanics that involves the Earth's position around the sun, the moon's position around the Earth, how all these things come together. And then there are a number of cycles of lunar and planetary motion that combine to create the length of the path, the width of the path, where the path goes. All of these things mix together in a way that might not cause an eclipse to come back to a particular location for another 600 or more years.
The three needed ingredients, the Earth, the Sun, and the Moon. And regarding the latter, I understand there is more discoveries of water. Are we talking molecules, milliliters, or buckets?
It depends where you're going to measure. If you're measuring right out on the surface of the moon, well, we're talking molecules. The way in which sunlight bombards the moon allowed for the combination of molecules to form into water, and then that was freezing in the craters that were constantly in the dark. Not very much water. This new study is suggesting that the interior of the moon, the mantle just under the crust, has far more water in it than we originally suspected.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Fitz, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.